almost as though the same string that yanks me toward him binds him, too. A white rose dangles from his fingers. My mouth goes dry. We meet in the middle of the sidewalk, and by the look in his eyes, I'm immeasurably glad I wore the white dress.
"I wondered if you would come,"
he says, his voice low. I questioned it myself a time or two, I admit. Pablo holds the flower out to me, and I take it from his hands, the silk soft against my palm, the simple beauty of it tugging at my heart. I'm grateful for its resilience, that I won't have to watch it age and turn to dust, that I may tuck the rose into a drawer somewhere and pull it out, stroking its petals when I feel the need to remember. Thank you. My words are both far too little and all I can afford to give.
Would you like to walk?
He asks. I nod, not quite trusting my emotions enough to speak. Pablo positions himself between the street and me, although really both sides possess equal treachery. On the one side there are the lanes of traffic, cars whizzing by, the opportunity for recognition high. On the other there is the water, the ocean crashing over the seawall, splashing pedestrians, the sea invading the street with Poseidon's angry wrath. Today, though, the waters are relatively calm, and there is little chance of the saltwater marring my dress, merely the walk sullying my reputation. We walk in silence, Pablo measuring his stride against mine, seemingly content to follow my lead and opt for silence rather than meaningless conversation. I clutch the rose in my hand, every so often stroking the soft silk. Each time I do, there's a hitch in his stride, as though he is aware of every twitch of my fingers, the rise and fall of my chest, the sound of my heart thudding in my chest. The wind blows a strand of my hair, and I tuck it behind my ear, only to be rewarded by his sharp intake of breath. The air around us crackles with energy. I avert my gaze from him, needing the moment to collect myself. As I survey the landscape around us, the others walking along the promenade, it's impossible to miss that there's a tension emanating all around us. There are fewer tourists than you typically encounter on the Malecón. The attacks at the Montmartre Cabaret and the Tropicana have rattled nerves, and people are on edge. Then there are the bombs exploding around the city at random intervals, interspersed between parties, elegant dinners and lunches, and trips to the beach. And Nero fiddled while Rome burned. Some of these explosions make the newspaper the next day. Other times they don't, and we're left wondering if the loud booms, the screaming, were figments of our imagination, the product of a city poised for the next burst of violence. It's hard when a country descends into such turmoil. Harder still when there are so many groups vying for power, attempting to feast on the carcass of a dying island. There are, were, the Organización Auténtica, an ill-fated group of guerrilla fighters, the Directorio Revolucionario Estudiantil, a group of students from the University of Havana, the mostly defunct Federación Estudiantil Universitaria, another group of students from the University of Havana, who together with the DRE fought their way into the presidential palace and attempted to assassinate Batista last year. Members of the Communist Party, whose uneasy alliance with Batista wanes. The 26th of July movement, fighting Batista's army in the Sierra Maestra Mountains. And any number of other enemies Batista has garnered over the years. The waves crash over the seawall ahead, spilling onto the road, their white foamy caps full of such energy that they appear alive. We pause and wait for the sea to cease its angry assault, and I take the opportunity to do what I've wanted to do since we began walking. I stop and look at Pablo, my gaze hungry, lingering over his features, the faint lines around his eyes, the hint of darkness beneath them, as though he did not sleep well last night.
"I saw you in the paper this morning,"
he says, standing just a bit closer to me than is necessary to be heard over the sound of the waves,
the noise from the street. I flush. I didn't take you for someone who reads the society pages. I'd counted on that, actually. This time it's his cheeks that look a bit ruddy. I'm not. At least, I wasn't until today. He swallows, his Adam's apple bobbing. The words hover in the air between us, unspoken. Until I met you. You know who I am, then?
Yes.
I look out to the sea, my heart pounding. Then you know this afternoon is all I have to give. There is a difference between small rebellions like sneaking out at night with my sisters, and big ones like falling in love with a man and going against my family's wishes. I stand on the precipice of one, and I need the reminder, perhaps more so than he does, that I must not, under any circumstances, allow myself to give in to the temptation. It's not just my reputation, or my mother's and father's, but it's Beatrice's reputation, and Isabel's, and Maria's. I've seen firsthand what can come of going against our parents' wishes. Moreover, it's not lost on me that at 19, I have limited skills, that if I was cast out of the family, I would have a very hard time supporting myself, especially with the employment challenges facing Cuba.
Yes, Pablo responds.
My gaze sweeps across the seawall, at the people around us. There are so many different versions of Cuba before me. Tourists, locals, all of us inhabiting different realities within Havana. Which one is this? Tell me about yourself, so I will have something to hold on to when I must forget you.
What would you like to know?
He asks. Anything. Everything. I start with the little I do know about him. You mentioned you grew up in Vedado. Does your family still live there?
They do. My parents and two sisters.
His voice cracks.
I haven't seen them in a while, though. I've been away.
There's a hint there. A thread of family discord I'm uncomfortably familiar with lingering behind his words. There are natural pauses in conversations when one speaks of family estrangement. The inadequacy of words to convey the unnatural state of breaking from those to whom you are bound in blood. The pauses physically manifesting themselves in an empty chair at an ostentatious dining room table that hailed from Paris. I know all about those pauses. A relationship severed at the knees. A sibling lost to ideology. A family forever fractured. I fight to keep the tremor from my voice. Are you back for good now? I'm not quite sure which answer I wish to hear. This will be easier if he is to go. A clean break.
No. Only for a short time. I have business in the city.
I wait for him to elaborate, and when he doesn't, I press on. Do you like your job? Practicing law? I know enough about topics I've studied in heavy books given to me by tutors, but I know little of the practical applications of things. Lawyers dine at our table occasionally. However, the conversation rarely turns to their work or anything of substance.
I like it well enough, I suppose, he answers. I enjoy helping people. Trying to, at least. Justice in Cuba.
His voice trails off. But I'm not so oblivious to the reality around me to not fill in the blanks. Most of my education on Cuba's political condition was given to me through the walls of my father's study in the form of the angry shouts and recriminations I've overheard. How can you justify the way we live? People are starving, suffering. You built your fortune on the backs of others. We all have. Up ahead, a group of boys dive for coins left by American tourists, the children's bodies bobbing against the waves, before disappearing beneath the surface in waters likely overrun by sharks. All for a few coins.
These are difficult times, Pablo says,
his gaze, like mine, on the boys.
So many of my friends graduated from university years ago and can't find jobs. They're frustrated and they're angry.
And they're scared for their future.
He turns from the boys, back to face me. I took some time off from practicing law to focus on other things. The phrase, other things, dangles ominously between us. The winds of change coming from the former students of the University of Havana, who are now left without a place to study since Batista closed the university out of fear for their subversive activities, have already torn through my life once. This is one afternoon, one indulgence. I don't need to know all his secrets. Can pretend he is merely an attorney. Nothing more.
What about you? Pablo asks.
What about me?
You never really answered me before. What is life like on the other side of the gates?
I laugh softly, relieved to be back on firmer ground. Not as exciting as people seem to imagine. Pablo is silent for a moment. His gaze far more intense than an afternoon walk on the Malecón merits. Everything about him is intense. When he discusses politics, when he looks at me, it's that intensity that has me gravitating toward him. It's refreshing to be around someone who cares more about substance than frivolity. He reminds me so much of my brother. Alejandro has that same determined glint in his eyes, the same conviction underscoring each word. Pablo grins.
So, if you aren't marching all over Havana, capturing hearts, what do you do in your free time?
I spend time with my sisters. I have three. And a brother no one speaks of anymore. I read. I go shopping. We like to ride horses. Go to the beach. I don't mention the social obligations. It all sounds so frivolous and tedious. And it is. This waiting around for a man to walk into our lives and marry us. A part of me envies Alejandro for his ability to cast off the weight and responsibility of being a Pérez, the ease with which he is willing to risk everything for his beliefs. And at the same time, there's an anger there I cannot erase. Loyalty is a complicated thing. Where does family fit on the hierarchy? Above or below country? Above or below the natural order of things? Or are we above all else loyal to ourselves, to our hearts, our convictions, the internal voice that guides us? I wish I knew.
I'm surprised you're not in school overseas somewhere.
My mother didn't support us going to university. Beatriz lobbied the hardest for it. She would have made an excellent attorney. But in the end, it wasn't worth the fight. My parents have a very traditional view of what it is to be a woman in Cuba, and no matter how much society might disagree with them, they weren't going to change their opinions. A working Pérez woman is a blight on the Pérez name. He looks faintly outraged.
So you're just what? Supposed to wait around until one day you move from your parents' home to your husband's?
Yes.
What if you never marry?
Then I'll stay in our house taking care of my mother until I grow old. I don't find the idea any more appealing than he does, but I don't know how to explain to him how few options are afforded to us. I suppose I could break from family tradition, go against my parents' wishes, but the truth is there's never been anything I've been passionate enough about to risk severing all ties with my family. I don't possess secret dreams of being a doctor or lawyer. I'm 19, and I don't know what my future looks like. Harder still to predict when I'm surrounded by such uncertainty.
And you're happy with that?
He asks, his expression doubtful. No, of course not. But you speak as though there are limitless options available to me.
What if there could be?
I have no interest in politics, I reply. It is both warning and caution. I have no interest in revolution, and even a hint of it. Bombs aren't the only things that go off in Havana. President Batista's firing squads have been especially prolific lately, and no Cuban, regardless of their wealth, is above his notice. My own brother is proof of that. The best thing to do, the smart thing, the way to survive in Havana, is to keep your head down and go about your daily life as though the world around you isn't creeping into madness.
You speak as though politics is its own separate entity, he says, as though it isn't in the air around us, as though every single part of us isn't political. How can you dismiss something that is so fundamental to the integrity of who we are as a people, as a country? How can you dismiss something that directly affects the lives of so many?
Very few can afford the luxury of being political in Cuba.
And no one can afford the luxury of not being political in Cuba, he counters.
The fervor lingering in his words, the conviction with which he speaks them, transforms him before my eyes. His overlong hair blows in the breeze, his dark eyes flashing. And there's something about the ferocity in his gaze that reminds me of the corsair on our wall at home. This is not the sort of man who waits for permission, but a man of action. A man of deep, abiding passion. What would it be like to have such a man be mine? Aren't you tired of keeping your head down and praying for invisibility? He asks, his voice soft. His question tugs at me, the undeniable fact that I am both attracted to and repelled by this zeal within him. How many hours have I spent having these very conversations with my brother, and in the end, where did it leave us? I didn't lie. I have no interest in revolution, in armed revolt, in killing. There are women who fight this battle for Cuba's future, but I have no desire to join their ranks. For my presence to be excised from our family as Alejandro's has been. But the freedom Pablo speaks of? The love for his country that infuses each word that falls from his lips? There is beauty behind that sentiment, and a devotion that is admirable. Batista's policies aren't about Cuba, or what's best for the Cuban people. They're designed to serve Batista, to increase his wealth, his power, to keep his stranglehold on the island forever. Do we all dare to hope for more? Of course. But it's hard to hope when all you've known is corruption, when your reality is rigged elections and the possibility of more of the same. I admire his hope. I envy it. And even more, I fear it. Pablo shakes his head.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't speak of such things.
A rueful smile settles on my lips. You don't strike me as the sort of man who worries about should.
That's true, he concedes, his mouth quirking.
We walk side by side, the sun shining down on us, close but not touching. His lean, tall frame shields me from the view of onlookers. My hair blows in the breeze with the faintest gust of wind, and he inclines his head, watching the strands in the light. His expression softening. My cheeks heat again. I'm not normally this serious. Not normally this shy. But everything about this feels different. Important somehow. There are a finite number of minutes left in this one afternoon I've granted myself. And I'm torn between hoarding them, feasting on every look, every word, and making the most of them. Filling the spaces in our conversation with words I've yet to seize. The rose is almost unbearably soft in my hands.
Have you read Montesquieu?
Pablo asks, the question catching me off guard. I haven't.
You should. His words never seem more true to me than when I am in Havana.
He turns away from me, his gaze sweeping over the buildings on the other side of the Malecón.
Montesquieu said that an empire born in war must maintain itself by war.
Cuba is hardly an empire, I interject.
True. The spirit is similar, though. When have we ever not been at war? With others, Spain and the United States, with ourselves.
Are we to be forever at war, then? I counter. Why do men always think war is the answer?
Alejandro was eager to take up arms against Batista, to spill Cuban blood, and for what? Batista remains in power, and all it earned Alejandro was exile from Havana. Officially, my parents have told their friends he is studying in Europe, traveling the world. There are whispers, of course, but no one has the temerity to challenge my father or mother, to ask if the rumors are true. My brother, Beatrice's twin, is a radical.
Bombs are exploding in movie theaters, I argue. Dead bodies litter our streets. Are those not Cuban lives being taken? Innocents caught in the middle of a fight that is not their own?
You speak as though all Cubans should take up arms. But what if we don't want the same things?
Then what?
And what of those who stand by and do nothing while a tyrant runs our country into the ground, slaughtering our countrymen because they speak out against his injustices? What is the cost of inaction, of turning away when atrocities are committed in the name of Batista? There is a disconnect between those in the city who yearn for change and those who pretend everything is grand. The industries we rely on as a nation, sugar, tobacco, coffee, tourism, enslave us as a nation, as a people, who serve others in the fields, in the casinos and hotels run by American scoundrels.
I flinch as the word sugar falls from his lips. What must he think of my family? Of me? He is here, walking beside me, and yet I can't help but wonder if he doesn't see my father as part of the problem. Alejandro certainly did.
The Americans control so much of our industry, our economy, and who benefits from that largesse?
Batista, he continues.
The rich are extravagantly rich, and the poor are so desperately poor.
Everything disappears. The roar of the malecón, the noise from the road. I can't tear my gaze away from him, the conviction in his voice mesmerizing. With each word that falls from his lips, he's transformed. The serious man I met at the party last night has been replaced by someone else entirely.
When I am in the country, I see my fellow Cubans without electricity, running water, unable to read, their children unable to go to school,
Pablo says, his gaze once again on those looming buildings.
When I am in Havana, the lights are on, people walking down the Paseo del Prado as though they do not have a care in the world. There are other parts of the city, far too many, where people are suffering tremendously. Yet it still feels as though Havana exists in its own self-contained bubble. I was a boy in 33 when we overthrew Machado. I understand that people are tired of violence, tired of conflict, tired of Cuban blood spilling. But I have a brother.
The words tumble out without thought. The secret that isn't really a secret at all. He shared those thoughts once. Beside me, Pablo stills, as though he is adept at reading the pauses in a conversation. The tense, unfinished sentences and words uttered in a whisper.
Families can be hard, he says after a moment.
Yes.
Is he safe?
He asks, as though he too knows a thing or two about the precariousness of going against one's family, defying one's president. I hope so. I wish I possessed more optimism to inject in those words. In any event, I have not read Montesquieu, but I will search for his work in our library. I flinch as the word leaves my mouth. But really, what's the point in pretending? He's seen the newspaper, knows my last name now. As much as I envy Alejandro, his freedom, I lack the ability to cast off my family, to repudiate them and all they stand for. We are flawed, yes. But the legacy and blood that binds us is inescapable. Yes, my father has a library in his home, the walls brimming with books, I continue, my tone dry. I'm sure you think us decadent. We are decadent. My family's fortunes were cast a long time ago, and those of us born under the Pérez name have enjoyed the benefits of that wealth.
And would you apologize for it?
His tone is idle, but there's real interest behind his words.
For my family's fortune? For the grand house and the rest of it? You could strip away the paintings, except for the corsair. I am indeed quite fond of him, and I do not think I would mind. I cast a sidelong glance his way, attempting to take his measure. Or perhaps I would be better served by exclaiming my disgust with our wealth, and the shame that it brings me? Or tell you of our charitable endeavors, the men who served in the military and died for Cuba's independence, my father's efforts to work with Batista drafting the 1940 Constitution, the ancestors who have served in the national legislature. I sigh. Perhaps our legacy will always be that we have more than we ever need in a country where many do not have enough. And even so, I see the limitations my father faces, the whims of the sugar crop that was once booming and now keeps him up working late in his office. I overhear his strained conversations, the broken promises, the fears over the direction in which the country is headed. Even the wealthy are not immune. We have friends who have been thrown in Batista's prisons. We fear the firing squad as much as the poor. My own brother is evidence of that. Money buys us the proximity to power, but in this current climate, that proximity is a target on all our backs. My little speech leaves me a bit breathless, the ferocity of it catching me off guard. When was the last time anyone asked me what I thought? How I felt about the world swirling around me? When was the last time I was able to utter Alejandro's name? I sneak a peek at Pablo, wondering if I've scared him off, the girl who is too free with her opinions. Instead, a gleam of admiration enters his gaze.
You're brave, Elisa Perez.
In a family such as mine, there are varying degrees of bravery. But I'll take the compliment all the same, even as I wonder just how brave I really am. Why me? I ask, pushing the limits of my alleged bravery a bit further, indulging the curiosity turning over in my mind. A moment passes before he answers me.
Because you're comfortable in your own skin. Because you appear content to show yourself to the world exactly as you are without deception or artifice. That's a novel quality these days, and I suspect in Miramar even more so.
It's the sort of compliment whose very nature makes testing the veracity of it exceedingly difficult, and the pleasure of it seems best savored with acceptance rather than dissection. I smile, though, holding his gaze for a moment, and lingering there before ducking my head and looking out to the sea. We both seem content to let the silence swallow us up, for the wind and the waves and the car horns to do the talking for us, a trumpet interjecting every so often, our bodies moving in tandem as we stroll along the promenade.
You're not what I expected,
he says finally, breaking the silence between us, his words little more than a whisper, an aside to himself that I'm privy to.
Does he feel it, this thing between us, too?
What did you expect? I can't resist asking.
I don't know. Not this. I didn't expect to meet someone.
His words disappear with the wind. They seem safer there.
Elisa.
I turn and face him, the sun bright in my eyes, casting a glow around him. I fear he can see every single emotion, the worry, the confusion, the desire, in my gaze, stamped across my face. Deep down, I know what he is. How can I not? It couldn't be clearer if it was written in the sky before me. Deep down, a part of me gravitates toward what he is, even as I am horrified by it.
Elisa,
he repeats. A tremor trails down my spine at the sound of my name falling from his lips, at the husky timbre of his voice.
Enough.
One of us moves. Both of us move. I don't even know anymore. Only that his lips meet mine, and it is both everything and nothing that I expected. For all that I anticipated, imagined, my first kiss, the reality of it, comes to me in pieces, fractured moments unfurling themselves. His hand on my waist, the brush of his fingers against the fabric of my dress, his lips on mine. his breath becoming my breath, his heart thudding against my chest. He strokes my hair, fisting the strands as the kiss changes, deepening, leading me into treacherous waters until I'm left gasping for air. Pablo pulls back first, staring down at me with those dark, solemn eyes. I should take a step back, and another, until I'm safely ensconced in the mansion in Miramar. I step forward, laying my palm on his cheek, my fingers sweeping across the dark shadows just beneath his eyes. He shudders. In one step, I know power, the drugging effect of it coursing through my veins. With one step, I am removed from the fringes and thrust in the middle of my life. In that space of the step, my world shifts. Everything is different now, and nothing will ever be the same again. Chapter 7. I stay up late into the night reading and rereading the letter Pablo wrote me. He pressed it into my palm after he walked me home, the paper still warm from its place in his pocket, the intimacy of it sending a flutter through my chest. We said goodbye yesterday on the fringes of Miramar so no one would see us together, our parting paltry compared to the kiss on the Malecón. I regret the circumstances between us, the need to keep him a secret, tucked away in the fringes of my life. His words speak of the same frustration within him, the same yearning for more. I am at a disadvantage. When I went to Guillermo's, I never imagined I'd meet you. And then you were there, so beautiful it hurt. You looked so earnest watching everyone, as though you attempted to commit every moment to memory. As though you feel the same restlessness inside you, the same desire for more than that which life has given you. I know this is foolish. You have everything in front of you, and I have nothing to offer, no place in your life. It is likely premature to think about these things, to worry about them, when I've only known you a moment. How can time feel both unending and entirely too finite? Pablo's letter tugs at something inside me like a loose thread, unfurling the tightly wound knot in my chest as I clutch the pages in my hand. Time is a luxury I don't have. Seeing him in person brings its share of risks, and I spend far too much time grasping for words when we're together. Here, in the comfort of my room, reading the words he has written, I learn about him, his family, his passion for the law, his favorite books. His words linger, long after I've finished reading them, the remnants of our conversation on the Malecón imprinted in my mind. Despite having traveled abroad with my parents, I've seen very little of Cuba outside of Havana, have limited knowledge of the struggles those outside the city face. He's right. We do live in an insular society. But what will change? How can it change? Hours before dawn, I begin crafting my own letter. I'll give it to him when I see him again. My hand shakes as I put the words on the page, my normally neat penmanship devolving into an unpleasant scrawl. Still, this is easier for me. It's clear Pablo attended university, studied law. He speaks with a confidence and quick-wittedness I both admire and envy. The words I write have only ever existed for me in the pages of the books I read, shoved tightly into the recesses of my mind, uttered in the confines of my home. Women in my circle do not speak of these things in public, and in this house we no longer speak of them in private either. In the early morning, I pluck Montesquieu from a shelf in my father's library. I curl up in one of the oversized chairs that has been in our family since before he or I were born, flipping through the pages until the lack of sleep becomes too much for me, and my eyes shudder. When I wake, it's to the sound of the door opening and closing with a gentle thud, followed by light footfalls on the carpet. The smell of perfume announces her presence before I open my eyes, Beatrice's signature scent. I feel her presence hesitating near me, her body still, waiting to see if I'm still sleeping. I keep my eyes closed. A surreptitious Beatrice is a dangerous one, and the feeling that she's up to something has plagued me since the night she insisted we attend the party in Vedado. The sound of footsteps, muffled by the carpet now, continue, and then stop. I open one eye slowly. Beatrice stands with her back to me, leaning over the wooden desk. Our father prefers to work privately in his study, reserving it as his inner sanctum. But he also keeps a desk here in the opulent library, where he entertains guests and business associates as the mood suits him. As far as rooms go, you can't get much more impressive than thousands of antique books collected by centuries of Pérez ancestors. The sound of drawers opening and closing, knobs rattling, fills the room. My breath hitches. Beatrice turns. My eyes slam closed.
There's no use, you know. I've slept in the same bedroom as you before. You snore when you're truly asleep,
Beatrice calls out from across the room. That's the trouble with sisters. They know you far too well. I open my eyes, rising from the chair, picking up the copy of Montesquieu that tumbled to the floor when I fell asleep. Should I be concerned by the fact that you're skulking around Father's desk? I ask. Knowing Beatrice as I do, her actions could be the result of a number of things, but it's a not-so-hidden family secret that my father often keeps cash in his desk. Not a lot, of course, but... Beatrice walks over to me, her gaze drifting to the book perched in my hand.
Montesquieu?
How egalitarian of you.
A twinkle gleams in her eyes. I ignore the teasing note in her voice, the curiosity contained there. What are you doing going through his desk? I repeat. This time it's Beatrice's turn to look abashed. Money? Beatrice flinches. Have you heard from Alejandro? I ask. Of all of us, Beatrice and Alejandro are the closest, perhaps by virtue of being twins. She's certainly taken his rift with the family the hardest. Beatrice was born first, and their relationship has always reflected that. She sneaks out of the house at all hours, taking packages bundled up from the kitchen among other items. She claims it's charity, of course, but as I said, sisters always know you far too well. Beatrice glances at the closed door, fear flickering in her gaze. If our father is willing to disown his heir, then none of us are safe from his ire, even his favorite child.
Alejandro is in Havana, she admits, keeping her voice low. He needs money.
Is that why you wanted to go to the party? To meet up with Alejandro?
She nods.
Beatrice!
Her expression turns defiant.
He's my brother. What would you have me do?
If Father finds out...
He'll what? Disown me, too?
Yes.
Fine. Let him. I can't keep pretending things are normal when they're not. That our family is whole when it's not. What has Alejandro done that was so wrong?
He attempted to assassinate the president, I hiss. Participated in it, at least. He might not have been one of the men who stormed the presidential palace itself, but he planned the failed attack just the same.
He needs our help,
Beatrice argues.
He needs to leave Cuba,
I counter. How long can Alejandro escape Batista's notice? How long before he is killed? The grandfather clock chimes, cutting off Beatrice's response. I agreed to meet Pablo at a restaurant in the Chinese quarter of the city for lunch. If I leave now, hopefully I won't be late. The unexpected nap took quite the chunk out of my day. Montesquieu dangles from my hands.
I need to go. We can finish this later.
Beatrice rolls her eyes.
Must we?
Her gaze drifts to Montesquieu and back to my face again.
Meeting Anna?
We've become masters in the art of reading between the lines of each other's conversations. The art of having our own intimate discussions without saying the words aloud, cultivated by the need to circumvent our parents' notice. She doesn't believe for a second that I'm meeting Anna. And in that moment, a truce is born. She'll look the other way while I head off to my assignation, and I won't say anything about her helping our brother.
Not that I would have anyway. In our younger years, we likely would have sealed our pact with a secret handshake or something similar. Now all it takes is a nod and a few parting words before I'm on my way out of the house, only to be stopped by Maria. The curse of having three sisters. It takes every excuse I can think of to keep Maria from tagging along with me as I walk down the front stairs, the letter I've written Pablo tucked inside my purse. She trails behind me like a shadow.
Please, Elisa, I just finished my math lessons. We can go shopping. I need a new dress.
I laugh. I seriously doubt you need a new dress. Even though Maria is the most rambunctious of us all, our mother insists on dressing her as though she's a little doll, each gown itchier and fuller, more and more elaborate than the one before it. The age difference between Maria and me is due in part to the cooling relations in our parents' marriage, and punctuated by the loss of the child our mother miscarried. While Isabel, Beatriz, and I have had one another, and occasionally Alejandro, Maria's age has set her apart, leaving her more firmly in our mother's care. Maria's lower lip juts out. I try a different tactic, guilt filling me. I'm meeting Anna for lunch. Liar. What if we get ice cream when I come back? She hesitates.
Coconut?
Her weakness for sweets is another not-so-well-hidden family secret. Whatever you want. I don't blame her for wishing to accompany me. Life in the Perez household has become incrementally more restrictive with each act of violence in Havana. Batista might attempt to convince the rest of the country that the unrest is contained to a few isolated incidents firmly under his control, but our mother isn't fooled, nor is she willing to expose her daughters to anything deadly or unseemly. More reason why today's outing must be a secret. I leave Maria playing the piano, our ice cream date secured, and make my way to central Havana, already a few minutes late. Sneaking out is becoming a habit, one I'm surprisingly good at, and a skill I wished I'd discovered in my younger years. I can only imagine the adventures I would have had. I walk through the enormous gate heralding the entrance to the Barrio Chino, stepping into an unfamiliar part of the city. Havana and her secrets. When we dine out, my parents tend to favor places like La Zaragozana or the many French restaurants that have sprung up in recent years. I can't recall if I've ever been to this part of the city, at least not since I was a child. Sugar's heavy influence over our fates and fortunes is evident here, too. It was sugar that brought the Chinese workers to the island long ago. Some of the workers returned to China when their contracts had ended, but many stayed, finding their home in Havana and the countryside. Looking around me, it's impossible to ignore the fact that my family has played a role in an industry that has supported the economy for so long, and at the same time, taken so much from its people, bringing wealth and prosperity to the island on the backs of so many. Our lifeblood as a nation is also a source of shame. I like to believe my father is a fair man, that he treats his workers well, pays them justly for their efforts. But I am not so sheltered as to believe it has always been thus for those who work the fields. It was sugar that kept us under the yoke of the Spaniards, that brought slaves to our shores, meant workers languished under harsh conditions, gave the Americans a heavy interest and control over our fortunes. The island gives and the island takes in one fell swoop. This is the legacy my brother rebels against, the cause that drives him. Is it Pablo's cause, too? Once I'm through the gate, I'm surrounded by a mixture of Spanish and Chinese spoken around me, the signage in characters I can't read. The scents in the air are familiar, yet not. The smell of roast pig is mixed with seasonings and spices I can't identify, spilling from tiny restaurants and storefronts. Bodies are crammed more tightly together here, and I fight my way through the crowd looking for... Pablo leans against a building with a red awning, his gaze scanning the street, settling on me. He's dressed casually today, his long legs encased in buff-colored pants and a paper-thin linen shirt, a concession to the heat, I imagine. He pushes off from the wall and walks toward me, a smile on his face that has my heart pounding.
I wondered if you would come,
he says once again, as though this is becoming our standard greeting, acknowledging the uncertainty between us. He steps forward, pressing a kiss to my cheek. It's only been a day since we last saw each other, but I can't deny the urgency in my limbs, the eagerness in my heart. I'm sorry I'm late. My sisters... I don't know how much to share with him about my family, this man about whom I know so little. It's one thing to trust him with my heart, and another entirely to trust him with my family. It's complicated, I say, realizing my words offer little explanation. Pablo nods.
I appreciate you meeting me here. I thought it would be better if we went somewhere you aren't known, where you don't have to worry about being seen.
He's right about that. Everyone is busy going about their day. No one bothers to glance our way. There's freedom in the anonymity this part of Havana affords us, which has me standing just a bit closer to him than I normally would. It makes it easier that Pablo understands the risks I'm taking, but at the same time, I can't deny the thread of shame that fills me. Surely he deserves better than a girl who fears going against her family's wishes. This is perfect. I don't think I've ever been to this part of the city before, I reply.
We used to come here when we were younger. My father would bring me and my sisters to buy fireworks. You've never seen fireworks such as these.
He smiles, and I suspect he's caught in a memory.
We used to fight over who would light them.
I grin. That sounds like something my siblings and I would do.
Are you hungry?
He asks after a moment. I nod.
There's a good place right around the corner. They have the best Chinese food in the city.
Pablo takes my hand and I link my fingers with his. I'm grateful I removed my gloves before I came, that I'm able to touch him like this, our bare skin clasped together. His thumb strokes the inside of my palm. He walks with purpose, navigating the crowds with ease. We walk past a business Pablo identifies as the famous Pacifico and stop outside a tiny restaurant shoved in between several other businesses on the narrow street. The sounds of the restaurant spill out onto the street, the inauspicious front incongruous with the lively interior. It's not La Zaragozana or the Tropicana, but I like it more for the fact that it too, like Pablo, doesn't stand on ceremony. Other men might have taken me to the finest restaurant in the city in an effort to impress, but I appreciate this more, his desire to show me somewhere special, to share this secret with me.
I promise the food is some of the best you'll ever eat, he says.
I smile. It's wonderful. We walk inside, and an elderly Chinese man leads us to a small table in the back of the space. The restaurant is narrow and long. The tables around us are empty, the front filled with groups of men eating and playing dominoes. I'm happy to have Pablo order for me, content to watch him laugh with the waiter as they converse in Spanish. When he's finished ordering our meal, the man leaves us and we're alone once again. Neither one of us speaks for a moment that stretches on and on, until I can no longer take the silence. There's too much at stake here for me to be demure. Too much that hangs in the balance for me to be my mother's daughter, eyes cast downward and only speaking when spoken to in polite society. Before the kiss on the malecón, I was content to keep things casual. Now I know that possibility is behind us. What do I need to know about you? I ask, keeping my voice low. We're far away from the rest of the diners, but you never know when the wrong person will overhear a dangerous conversation.
Elisa!
I shake my head, cutting off any protest. Perhaps this is fast. Maybe it's too much for me to ask these things. But in this climate, I'm not sure the rules for polite behavior apply anymore. We are entangling ourselves, and I need to know how risky it is. I read your letter. You've given me pieces of it, and I think I know. But I need to hear the rest, need to know what I am getting myself into, what I need to protect. Our hands rest inches from each other on the table, and even as I attempt to keep my feelings for him at bay,
I want him to take my hand again, to feel those calluses against my skin. Foolish girl. Pablo sighs. You have to be careful. You can't trust anyone. The things I tell you, you can't tell anyone. Lives depend on it. He searches my gaze and I can feel him assessing, deciding whether he's going to trust me. That's the crux of it, isn't it? Does he merely view me as a silly debutante, pretty to look at but good for little else? Or does he see me as more, as an equal, someone he can confide in, someone he can trust? I was in the Sierra Maestra before I came here. I take a deep breath, steadying myself, even as I'm not completely surprised by his announcement. He is one of the bearded ones, the men who are fighting in the Sierra Maestra Mountains, broadcasting revolution on Radio Rebelde, the men my father decries each day. How did you become involved with them? I stare down at my knuckles, offering a prayer to the heavens that I have not just opened Pandora's box.
At the University of Havana. I told you I studied law. One of my classmates was involved in the revolutionary movement. I went to a few meetings with him. In the beginning, we marched in protest. There wasn't much organization in place, but we believed we had an opportunity to speak out against the injustices around us.
His voice hardens.
Batista promised to uphold the 1940 Constitution, to give us the rights we were promised. And then he reneged on that promise. Where is our freedom? Our liberty? How much of this country's wealth goes to the city, to Havana? The capital is littered with American casinos and hotels, populated by movie stars and gangsters, treating the country as though it is their own personal playground, while Cuban citizens in the provinces can't read, don't have access to basic necessities to meet their needs.
I heard the same sentiments from Alejandro not so long ago. An oath falls from Pablo's lips, his voice lowering.
The protests turned violent. It was inevitable, really. Any time we made progress, any time we attempted to reach the Cuban people, to spread our message in newspaper articles or on the radio, our words and actions were censored, our supporters hunted. Batista controls everything. The military, the media, the economy. We never stood a chance. And we aren't just fighting Batista. We're fighting the United States, who supports him year after year, who gives him weapons he uses to kill his own people, to maintain his hold on our island. How do a group of students chanting and marching create meaningful change if they aren't willing to embrace violence? How do you gain any power in a world where a few control all of it, if you aren't willing to wrest that power from them?
A chill seeps into my bones as his words hit home. Men like my father. How far is Pablo willing to go in his fight against Batista? Has he killed? Will he kill? Can we ever find common ground between us? Our love of Cuba, perhaps? Or are we destined to be on opposite sides? He cuts off his speech abruptly.
You're upset.
I am, but this hardly seems the time for delicate sensibilities. Tell me the rest of it.
I was at the Moncada barracks with Fidel. The soldiers opened fire on us. We thought we would catch them off guard, that everyone would be distracted by Santiago's carnival festivities, drunk and careless. But we missed something in the planning. And once we lost the element of surprise, it was all over. We shot at them until we had no bullets left. Men I'd laughed with, drank with, died beside me. And then we ran. Fidel wasn't so lucky. I escaped, helped him while he was in prison.
That was 5 years ago. I was a young girl when armed men attacked the Moncada barracks. The second largest military garrison in Cuba. In Santiago de Cuba, on July 26th, in Fidel Castro's failed attempt to seize control of the government away from Batista. The news said that the rebels boarded buses in Havana
and followed Fidel to the country, not realizing the details of their mission, failing to understand how suicidal it was, how they were outmanned and outgunned, armed with recklessness, idealism, and weapons that paled in comparison to those of the military. Men were killed that day on both sides, the trials that followed somewhere in the background of my childhood. I played with dolls while he went to war. So you have lived a dangerous life. He shrugs as though he takes no pride in the matter, as though such actions are merely a byproduct of doing what he believes to be right.
I have. It is dangerous to fight for what you believe in. It is also dangerous to speak of the corruption in Batista's government, of our dependence on the United States, to complain about unemployment, the failing economy, how sugar controls all of our fortunes.
He breaks off with a curse as I blanch. I've listened to the same words hurled at my father by my brother, except the difference between Pablo and Alejandro is that I'm familiar with Alejandro's disdain for Fidel in the 26th of July, his belief that they are not willing to go far enough in the change they wish to bring to Cuba, that the revolution they call for will not do enough to upend the economic disparities that have plagued our island since the Spaniards came. You hate my family, I say, my voice dull. Another oath falls from Pablo's lips, and in a flash I see the conflict in his eyes, the truth and the lie contained in his words.
If only it were that simple. I should hate your family. Men like your father have stolen this country from the rest of us. I should hate your family, but...
His voice trails off as though he cannot explain the vagaries of the human heart. I'm not my family, I protest, even as I recognize the falsehood for what it is as the words fall from my lips. It is a remarkably painful thing to have someone you care about and admire judge your existence, your very identity, the world you inhabit, and deem it rotten to the core. My brother hates everything about being a Pérez, and the more he professes his desire to distance himself from our family, the more it seems impossible for him to love those of us who were born into this lifestyle. I am my parents' daughter. How can you love something you denounce with such fervor?
Of course you are, Pablo says. It's in your bones. The tilt of your head, the sound of your voice, every step of your stride. You're a Pérez through and through.
And that's the problem. I don't know how to undo a lifetime of behavior, of rules, of manners that have been drilled into me. How to repudiate those I love the most. Beatriz, Isabel, Maria, my parents, Alejandro. We are not Batista, nor do we agree with many of his policies. But where is the difference between sin and survival? Does the benefit we receive from his position of power automatically damn us?
I wish things were simpler, Pablo adds. I wish you could live in my world, and I could live in yours. I wish there wasn't such a sharp divide between those who have everything and those who simply yearn for a chance at more.
And you think you can bring that to Cuba?
Me and others like me. Fidel Castro, for one.
I know little about Castro besides the mentions of him I hear in the news, and the derision in my brother's voice. Fidel is calling for those running for the upcoming presidential elections to be shot and jailed. He says he will bomb polling places where people will gather. Perhaps Pablo thinks he is a good man, but the little I've seen of him has yet to convince me. And as much as I might disagree with my brother, I can't ignore his thoughts on the matter either.
Were you with Fidel on the Granma? I ask.
Yes. I've been with him throughout the journey.
He's your friend.
I don't bother hiding the fact that I'm mildly appalled. My mother has always cautioned us that we are to be judged by the company we keep, and it is difficult to not do the same to Pablo, just as it appears difficult for him to not do the same to me.
He is, Pablo answers. He's also one of Cuba's best chances at stepping out from under Batista's shadow. He's a good man, a lawyer,
a reformer, a constitutional scholar, and a student of history.
The bombs going off around Havana. Some of